Right, okay. Yeah, thanks everyone for coming on this Saturday morning for the second talk of our Class Divide Summer School. So, we've got is it a yoga lesson. We've got Let Them Do Yoga, Inequality, Mental Health and Social Revolution, discussed by Brian Gardner. Thank you. Well, take it away.
Thank you very much, Mike. Good morning, everyone. Hopefully, people remotely on Discord can hear. I just want to thank the parties. IT committee, we're talking about mental health this morning. I think they're all extremely fucking stressed right now. So hopefully you can hear every dip out. Apologies, I have a microphone wrapped around my neck. I'm restricted in how far I can move. But we'll carry on regardless with the presentation. So, Mike asked me if I'd like to give a talk at this summer school. If my talk appears a little bit rushed and hurried and ill-prepared, that's because he only gave me 3 months' notice for this talk. clearly not enough. So I was up quite late last night, and I had this great idea that I was going to do an experiment with you as you came in. And then I chickened out about half an hour ago, and I decided we would just do a little thought experiment to kick off the session this morning. So just bear with me for this for the next 5 minutes or so. That's somebody leaving already. So imagine you came into this meeting this morning at 10 o'clock and all the chairs were stacked away. There's no chair available for you to sit in. And then you see that they're all stacked up down in the corner here. And comrade Paul Edwards is lounging on top of them all. And you go to him and you say, can we get one of those chairs for the meeting? And he waves you away with disdain and refers you to the chairman. And the chairman, Foster, says, no, comrade Edwards got in first. He's got all the chairs. You have a choice of standing for this talk or sitting on the cold, hard floor. So the point I'm making here is, how would you feel about that? How would you respond to that scenario that you're confronted with? Not my words to Scott, that wasn't me that said that. So there's two points I'm trying to make in this. Firstly, as I'm sure all of you realise, there's a little analogy here to the distribution of wealth inside capitalism. I don't want anyone to get angry with Conrad Edwards. I bravely volunteered him to be the capitalist class for this thought experiment. And the chairs represent, of course, useful wealth and resources. The first point I want to tap into is that scenario that I described. How would it actually make you feel? You know, on a sort of scale of 1 to 10, don't shout out, I don't need to know, just for your own personal reflection, how would you feel about that sort of scenario? I imagine you wouldn't be down at a 1 or a 2, you're not really bothered. You'd be a 4 or a 5, you're a bit aggrieved, it's a ridiculous situation that he can't share out the chairs with you. You would feel annoyed at the very least, I think. You would feel aggrieved, it'd be a bit of a personal affront to you. And that's not just because you're all revolutionaries and Marxists or anarchists. If we did the same little experiment with the Selly Oak Conservative Association, I think we'd get exactly the same sort of up-in-arms response to it. And bear in mind, what I'm talking about here is just standing for 90 minutes while somebody else is sitting. We're not talking about food and shelter and shoes for your children. You'd be incandescent with rage, actually, if that scenario unfolded. The meeting wouldn't go ahead. Quite simply. Now, as I said, last night I was thinking, let's see if we could do this. And this morning I thought, no. It's not good having violence at a party meeting, I think. But doing it as a thought experiment allows me to throw in another sort of variation to think about, however. If we look at a different context, you turn up for the meeting, as before, at 10 a.m, and you find there's a queue out the door. When you actually get in, it's standing room only. And I know that's hard to believe for Socialist Party members. Standing room only at a party meeting. So you're then forced to stand for the meeting or sit on the floor. Exactly the same scenario that you had that we described earlier on. Would you feel the same sense of anger? Would you feel the same sense of personal affront? Would you storm out annoyed? No, of course you wouldn't. Just a different context, the same material experience, but that subtle change in the context makes all the world of a difference. That's the thought experiment over. The purpose of it was just to try and demonstrate that the actual physical reality often isn't important, whether you're sitting on a seat or on the floor. It's the meaning that we take from it that is important, and that can actually cause us a great deal of stress. We can't ignore it. We try and deal with it, but it's quite personal. It's a personal affront. So that experiment was trying to make visible how central concepts such as fairness and equality are to the human experience. But what I want to really look at in this talk is how the experience of living generally in an unfair, unequal society, how that impacts under the radar, mostly, on the mental health of Homo sapiens and what insights that might give us into the complexity of inequality and the durability of inequality within class-based society. So that's the introduction. Just by way of preamble, there's a time lag here, or am I doing something wrong? Maybe I should put it on the presentation mode. So bear with me a wee second. So for those of you listening on Discord, you're not able to see the slides. You're not missing much. And I will describe, I'll try and describe what you're seeing just as soon as I can see it myself. So how important is mental health in the scheme of things? Just, I'm not wanting to labour this point particularly, but it's clearly going up the agenda in terms of its importance, greater awareness of the impact of mental health. And we're basically having a much more honest conversation as a society, I think, at the moment. And that can only be a good thing. And I haven't got much time in the talk, but historically there's been very much a mind-body sort of division between the two areas. And I think it's fair to say there's much more understanding now of the interplay between physical health and mental health as well. This diagram here shows the extent of physical long-term conditions. That's the circle on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side is a smaller circle of mental health. And then there's this interesting big chunk in the middle, but it's an overlap where the two are interplaying. That's only England, of course. Scotland's not on there because we are completely healthy. So what I'm wanting to do is to, before I look in more detail at some of the more recent research, which I think is very interesting stuff, I want to wind back a little bit and review what the Marxists and the broader left, perhaps, have had to say over the years in terms of understanding the social dimension to mental health. Psychology is, of course, a very new science. It's only been around for 150 years or so. And much of what would previously have been discussed under that sort of umbrella term was done in works of fiction, perhaps, or within the discipline of philosophy. So we have Charles Dickens, who skewered Victorian niceties and morals. And in David Copperfield, he outlined the famous quote from Mr. Micawber, describing, albeit bourgeois worries, but what he is describing here is, after all, the abiding stressor for every member of the working class, which is financial worries. And the difference between happiness and misery comes down at the end of the year to a matter of 6 shillings or so. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, 19, 19 and 6. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20, 0 and 6. Result, misery. It comes down to a matter of a few shillings per year, the difference between happiness and misery. Now, over a century ago, probably over 2 centuries, in fact, we learned that there was no point in treating patients with a disease like cholera by means of bloodletting or laxatives or leeches. The problem manifested in the body, but actually the problem existed outside the body in the sewage that was coursing down the street. And the problem demanded a public solution in the form of public health engineering. In contrast to physical diseases like cholera, mental health has been much more resistant to recognising the dynamic between the individual and their environment. The mental anguish that we can feel, anxiety, panic attacks, depression, these sorts of things, they exist in our heads, that's where we experience them, but the source is not necessarily any more internal than it is for something like cholera. The 18th century German philosopher Hegel placed a lot of emphasis on the concept of alienation. So I'm just going, just a very quick overview of bits where people have tried to understand psychology and the social dimension to it. So Hegel had this concept of alienation, which for him meant something to do with your alienation, your separation from God or some sort of spirit. Marx obviously repurposed Hegel in various ways, and he took this term alienation in a somewhat different fashion. Marx's main efforts were in analysing industrial capitalism, of course, and for him he was looking at the worker in a factory in contrast to a tradesman in his workshop, using his own tools and in charge of his own time and things like that. So for Marx, the industrial worker was alienated, and he identified four different ways that we could talk about that. Alienated from the product that they are making, they don't own it. Alienated from the process of production, they are an appendage to a line or a piece of equipment, working at the speed of the equipment. And also alienated from themselves in the process, they are now a wage slave, different from a human being. And finally, the fourth alienation was in relation to other members of their class, alienated from other human beings as well. So, as I've heard already, Dickens was talking about actual levels of wealth or poverty and the effect that that might have on your mental health. Writing 2 years earlier in 1847 in Wage, Labour and Capital, Marx offered a more sophisticated perspective, and I'm sure most of you will be well familiar with this quotation. For those of you on Discord, it's the one about a house that may be large or small. As long as the neighbouring houses are likewise small, it satisfies all social requirements for a residence. But let there arise next to the little house. I'm tempted to do this in a German accent like you did last night, but I'm not going to. Let there arise to the little house a palace, and the little house shrinks to a hut. I won't go through the whole quotation, but I think you get the idea. And what Marx is talking about here is relative poverty. And it strikes me, reading this again, is that it's really quite prescient, really quite sophisticated, and clearly illuminates this sort of problem that we're trying to address. Psychology moved on, became a distinct science in its own right at the end of the 19th century. In the early 20th century, Freud started to move it away from being just looking at the fundamental inherited characteristics or flaws of individuals, and looked at the early years and your early relationships with your mother or your carer as being a very important influence on your subsequent psychology. Very quickly trying to bring this up to date, across the 20th century there's been a distinct shift towards trying to recognise the social influence as well as just the internal ones. Erich Fromm was a Marxist psychoanalyst between the wars who tried to explore this interplay between the human and society. He was loosely associated with the Frankfurt School, whose main intellectual pursuit was in understanding what had gone wrong with Marxism. Why had the workers not revolted? Why had the Russian Revolution failed? Why had German workers, specifically, willingly fallen in step with fascism? The Frankfurt School were also interested in developments inside capitalism in the 20th century, mass production, mass communication, mass consumption. And this was a new arena created by capitalism into which the worker was entering now as a consumer. Slightly earlier in the late 19th century, Veblen had identified the psychological drives around a conspicuous consumption of the rich, who would spend money just to show that they could spend money. And in the late 20th century, 100 years later, Marcuse looked at conspicuous consumption, but now in terms of how this was spreading into the masses rather than just for the elite. But the offer from capitalism has always been pitched as follows. If you get rich, you can escape all these problems. But as we'll see, that's not entirely true. According to capitalism, increased wealth should have no real drawbacks to it. But in the 1950s, the term affluenza became common currency, popularised as researchers tried to understand the unpredicted unhappiness of the rich that was being uncovered at that time. So, sorry for that very fast overview of the development of sort of radical views around mental health and psychology. I'm sure I've missed lots out there, but there's a reason. We're going to pick up some of these points later on in the talk. An added complication in all this, an extra problem that capitalism gives us, comes from the ideology of capitalism. The onward march of capital during much of the last 50 years has been accompanied by a triumphalist culture which placed the individual centre stage. The previous societies maintained their authority, the authority of the ruling class, by a number of means, but a large part of this involved encouraging the view that your lords and your masters were godlike beings or supernatural, or at least close to that. Whereas you, the peasant or the serf, God had a different plan for you. You weren't meant to be ambitious. You weren't meant to be aspirational. Absolutely not. If you moved elsewhere to try and better yourself and get a better job, you'd be thrown in jail or worse. But the rise of capitalism threw away a lot of that superstitious nonsense. But in so doing, it removed a crucial buttress, an ideological support to class society. The burgeoning appeal of democracy, a bandwagon which capitalism jumped on relatively belatedly, this meant that the new rulers could not rely on some innate superiority or God-given rights. They had to be different from the old rulers, or at least had to try and look different. So their power and their privilege was a consequence of things like their hard work, of course, their thrift, their higher moral sensibilities, or their risk-taking abilities. And these concepts have grown and grown over the last century as the modern ruling class has usurped the aristocracy. So when the Berlin Wall came down and the free market model of capitalism felt able to go on the offensive ideologically, this message became louder and louder. Not only were the rich to be admired for their wealth, but for the effort and the skill that must have gone into them being rich and wealthy. After all, how else would they be rich and wealthy were it not down to their own individual skills? So what we get presented to us on the TV every week is the likes of Alan Sugar and The Apprentice or The Dragon's Den. And these capitalists are all portrayed as exciting self-made entrepreneurs. In the words of Duncan Ballantyne, the dour, miserable Scotsman, his biography, Anyone Can Do It. It's a very good read. I'd recommend it to you. That's a joke. But they really are the exception to the rule. The real capitalist class is not made up of risk takers or hard workers. It comprises people whose best decision in life was which bed they chose to be born into. And we'll come back to them shortly. Because as well as having to laud the rich and the wealthy, the real damage in this ideology of capitalism, this, you know, it's down to the individual, is in terms of what it does to the poor. In the famous words of Thatcher, being on a bus at the age of 26 marks you out as a failure. Full disclosure, I was on a bus yesterday coming here, so I must be a failure. And for the avoidance of doubt, I'm over 26. Just thought I'd mention that. What matters in this day and age, then, is your aspiration and your ambition, of course. So not only does the working class have to put up with the mental health stresses, the reduced welfare state to catch us and support us when things go wrong, we now are expected to internalise, in the way that the peasant and the serf presumably didn't, we have to internalise that sense of failure, and actually you have to feel bad about yourselves in the process. Now, socialists, we know that this is nonsense and we can mostly counter it, but it is nice to see some science backing us up. So I'm going to try and show some of that science now and look at the resilience of class inequality, which you don't hear about from the government. When they think they have to address this sort of issue, they set up departments of social. They don't set up departments of poverty. They don't set up agencies of inequality. That doesn't look good. It's not very sexy. So they set up social mobility departments. That sounds great. Social mobility. Who could complain about that? Except it just doesn't exist in reality, as we'll see with this example here. So in the last 10 years, some scientists have been doing studies on intergenerational social mobility by means of your surname. So I'll explain what that is. Surnames nowadays don't indicate your trade or profession. You don't have a Jimmy call centre or a Susan sales and marketing. But essentially, that's what happened in the 11th and 12th centuries. And scientists are able now to make reasonable assumptions about the relative class position of our ancestors based on the name. So, for example, take my name, Gardner. That's an easy one. My ancestors were hardy sons of the soil, skilled workers, getting their hands dirty, working the land on behalf of some parasite landlord. We could take some other examples at random, perhaps. Foster. Foster, for example, is a surname which derives from the ancient title and office bestowed upon those overseeing the upkeep and administration of the hunting territories belonging to the monarch. That's what your ancestors did, Mike Foster. Here's another one. We've got two Comrade Edwards in the room. Edward's surname derives from the Old English word Edward, which means prosperity guard. Dear, oh dear, comrades, this is very disappointing, isn't it? So while my ancestors were creating wealth, he puffs his chest out, the Fosters and the Edwards of the world in the 11th century were busy guarding that wealth on behalf of the rich. Now, the purpose of this exercise is not to try and embarrass your comrades for their ancestral unproletarian nature. That's just a side benefit from this exercise. The purpose of it is to show that there is a correlation, and I think it's a stunning correlation, to be honest, between your current 21st century class position and that of your ancestors 1,000 years ago. Bear in mind, we're talking about 30 generations. Your grandfathers, 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 15 times round. And think of all the revolutions and economic crises there's been in that time. Think of the shifts in production, and still we still see this correlation. It's quite stunning. And this study, this type of study, has been replicated many times. For example, an Italian study compared tax records for family dynasties identified by surname in Florence in Italy in 1427 and again in 2011. The top earners among the current taxpayers were found to have already been at the top of the socioeconomic ladder in Florence 6 centuries ago. This persistence is identified despite the huge political, demographic and economic upheavals that occurred during that time. Another example closer to home, looking at the entrance to Oxford and Cambridge in 1170, they found that intergenerationally, education access still shows influence 30 generations later. If your name was on the list to get in 1170, it's statistically more likely that you'll get in the 21st century. I find this stunning, this lack of social mobility. And just to put into context how significant it is, when I had my kids, the nurse that comes to your home, the health visitor, measures your child, asks the mother and father what your height is, and says, "Oh, right, your toddler is going to be 6'2" tall when they grow up." They have that confidence, knowing the height of the parents, they know what height your child's going to be. It's a very, very strong metric or correlation. But it's not as strong as the one I'm describing here, the economic one, the class one. It's actually a more powerful, it's not genetic, it's actually a more powerful correlation. So a tall capitalist is like to have a great-grandson that has average height, but that great-grandson will still have greater wealth than average. It doesn't dilute and disperse as quickly as does physical height. I find this stunning, to be honest. What's the phrase? Class is permanent. It really is. There's no such thing as social mobility. Wealth doesn't trickle down. It fossilises. And we know why this is. Coming back to my favourite TV show, Dragon's Den, we know why this is, because when we actually look at these capitalists that are portrayed to us as up-and-at-them entrepreneurs who started in the gutter, none of them started in the gutter. They all started up in the top 5-10% of the population. They all had a dad with a restaurant or something that they started with. So, take the example of Tej Lalvani. I'm sure you're all familiar with Dragon's Den. He inherited his dad's vitamin business. Doesn't mention that on Dragon's Den very much. He talks about, you know, you need to have a good business plan, you need to have sound cash flow. He never says to any of the competitors, oh, by the way, you need to have a good dad. And the next dragon is Deborah Meaden. She started a few businesses after she left school. They didn't go anywhere. But then she landed a plum job as managing director of her parents' business. That must have been a tough interview, that one, I think. You know, why do you want this job? Oh, shut up, Dad. Let's get on with it. And finally, there's Jenny Campbell, who identifies as a banker turned entrepreneur. And I was thinking, that's not a great ask, that is. That's not much to boast about. You started as a banker and you turned into an entrepreneur. If you start as a welder and turned into an entrepreneur, you might want to boast about that. So she was born into a family of bankers, builders and printers. She went to Manchester School for Girls. Automatically, I think you're probably in the top 10% to start with. The interesting thing about her is she only lasted 2 seasons in Dragon's Den, for those of you who follow it. She only lasted 2 seasons. Before announcing that she was departing the show, rather than help these people who come along pleading for money, she wanted to spend her time and put her investment into another entrepreneurial business that her sons were starting. She got fed up investing in other people's businesses. She wanted to go back to investing and keep it in the family, basically. That's how it works. That's why there's no social mobility. They keep it to themselves in the real world. That's why the Fosters and the Edwards to this day look down on the lowly gardeners if they get a chance at it. So a quick look at what makes class so incredibly resilient down the ages. Now turn to look at what this inequality has meant for human mental health. I've got a fantastic graph here, which hopefully we can show you. It's the hope that kills you, isn't it? You think it's going to work. Right. I meant to illustrate my last thing. That's the Dragon's Den, for those of you who don't know about it. Looking very power-dressed and imposing. And here's a graph that shows, for those of you, if you're still on Discord, the rising productivity over the last 50, 60 years, and round about the mid-70s, wages stopped being in lockstep with productivity and have flatlined since then. So what happened in the mid-1970s was a huge social experiment commenced amongst the developed economies, a concerted attempt by an increasingly politically conscious capitalist class to fight the class divide, not to bring it together, but to widen it. It sought to undermine trade unions and working class solidarity and weaken regulations and so on. And in the period since, it's acted to make work overall much more insecure for workers, more intensive with increased working hours and a much weakened safety net for those without employment. Now, it takes scientific research some time to catch up, particularly in the social sciences, but increasingly over the last 20 years, the data is now coming in from this significant change in working class, in the class division, I guess, in the class struggle. And there has developed a coherent body of research from epidemiologists, public health scientists, sociologists, psychologists and the rest, looking at what impact this acceleration of inequality has meant in terms of our mental environment and our mental health. Now, some of this is direct, the absolute material effects of experiencing poverty and what that does to your mental health. But as we'll see, there are more sophisticated and interesting angles to this as well. Now, the starting point for these new insights came from a very large study that was done in the 1960s. Executive burnout and stress was becoming an in thing, and the UK Civil Service participated in a study where thousands of civil servants were questioned and saliva samples were taken, that's some job to have that, to measure the levels of stress hormone amongst these civil servants. The study was commissioned in order to try and validate the hypothesis that the civil servants at the top of the tree, dealing with the government ministers and the big pressing issues of the day, trying to validate that they were subjected to higher levels of stress than were the lowly civil servants shuffling paperclips in an office somewhere. And in fact, the evidence proved the very opposite. It was 180 degrees different. Further studies then were commissioned to explore this and began to flesh out what was actually going on, which was that the level of stress you suffer matches into your level of responsibility, your level of control, your level of agency that you have or you don't have. The civil services, it was a good example. It still is a highly hierarchical work environment where your position and your status is quite visible to your peers, you know, all exacerbating the sense of pride or shame about your position. The higher up you are in this hierarchy, what they identified was it was a less stressful job. You had more control over what you'd been doing. And this has been replicated in hundreds of different work environments since then. So this is about comparison. It's not just about the sort of, Dickens, how much you're earning. It's about the comparison that somebody beside you has got a better house or a better job or a better status. But what is particularly interesting from research that has mushroomed over the last 30 years is that has identified something additional or something more going on. It's not just the actual level of wealth that you have or poverty you have. It's not just that your house is beside somebody who's got a big mansion, that direct, visible, conscious comparison. There's something else going on. So there's three mechanisms. There's the impact of wealth and poverty on your mental health. There's the impact on your mental health from a direct awareness that you lack, that you're not doing as well as somebody else perhaps. But there is this third angle as well, a third mechanism that's only really come out in the last 10, 15 years. And it's not about an absolute or direct impact. It doesn't need to involve a direct comparison with some other person, whether it's the civil servant or the mansion or the house. Instead, this third mechanism is it introduces the general social environment in which this is all taking place. It's about the level of inequality in that society, which will strongly influence just how bad the civil servant feels, just how bad the person in the shack feels next door to somebody in a mansion. In a hugely competitive, cutthroat, low-trust community, you'll internalise this much more and the health effects on you will be much more severe. In a more egalitarian, trusting society, it won't really matter so much. And this is a very important, it would appear, driver that exacerbates or mitigates the level of health impact that you feel from inequality. And the important thing to emphasise here is that while the examples of Mr. Micawber and his 6 shillings, or Marx and his house and his mansion, while they're direct and immediate and they're conscious, you know, you can point at the house, you can notice these things. This third aspect is subconscious. It happens without us knowing about it. Somewhere in your body, your senses are picking up constantly signals telling you about what sort of society am I in at any one time and how you should react. And it's training you and it's bracing you for insults and injuries and impacts. You're not telling the body what to do. It's evolved over the millions of years to be on guard, if needs be, all the time. And this seems to be a hugely important mechanism in terms of the health impacts of inequality on people in that society. So this was pulled together, as I said, the last sort of 20 years or so. There's been research, and I'm sure some of you will have read The Spirit Level, came out about 10 years ago. Fantastic book, recommend it to anyone. Absolutely full of graphs, you know, and data. And then just before the pandemic, they brought out a follow-up book called The Inner Level, which was just exploring this in a bit more detail. My reading of what's happened in the intervening 10 years is there's been no pushback from the usual suspects in the capitalist class to try and, you know, denounce or distract people from the spirit level. It's a very powerful indictment of capitalism and there really hasn't been any answer to it. In fact, the capitalist class have just, I think, they've kind of ignored it. The only thing I found was The Economist, a magazine about 10 years ago, when the spirit level came out, they had an editorial about it, and really their concluding remark was that, if I can find it, I can remember it, if you want happiness, don't go looking for it in capitalism. That was their argument. That's as good as they could get. Which is a great recruiting slogan for socialism, I reckon. They weren't going to argue the point. They've learned from the tobacco industry, don't talk about cancer, you're going to lose that argument. They've learned from oil and gas, don't talk about climate change, you're going to lose that argument. So there's really been no pushback on what I think is, you know, a stunning body of work that's been pulled together showing a real indictment of capitalism. Here's... you know, just one story. This is photographed last night from the book. Here's one graph showing income inequality along the bottom in different countries, and then looking at the percentage with any mental illness up this vertical axis here. So the more unequal the society gets, then the greater the mental illness there. So we're not talking about how rich the society is. We're talking about the level of inequality in it. And they've got hundreds of these graphs for specific types of mental health outcomes and for other outcomes, social outcomes on the back of that. Very, very powerful set of studies, I think. So I'm just going to... and I think the thing that's particularly interesting about this new research is that clear evidence that it's not just the poor whose mental health benefits. Sorry, it's not just the poor whose mental health benefits from greater equality. Actually, everyone in a particular society, even the better off, have improved mental health outcomes the less unequal the society is. It's just a measure of how intensely social the whole thing is. As individuals, I think we're just learning just how fine-tuned we are to our social environment. I guess that, you know, that we thought experiment at the start was just to show how a subtle little difference in the context completely changes how you feel about a situation, from being pretty angry to being completely chilled about it. And this is because, you know, we've evolved to be like this, haven't we? Our intelligence, our language, our ability for abstract thoughts, these are the things that are almost unique to us. They've evolved to such extent because we were living in cooperative groups and had to learn how to negotiate and navigate the increasingly complex brains of our fellow group members. So the selfish gene, sorry, not selfish gene, the spirit level, when it came out, some politicians said, oh, that's very interesting, we need to do something about that, we'll set up a social mobility commission. Great, good luck with that. But really, there's been no real engagement with it, no real attempt by capitalism to deal with this. As I said, I think they just ignored it. Let's put on a yoga session and hope it'll just go away. But for me, in terms of the impact on human beings, it's clearly up there with war, global poverty and climate emergency. It's a huge, huge challenge to capitalism, I think. Your economic system and the creation of inequality and your celebration of it is essentially at war with humanity, with who we are. We might not all break down or have to take medication about because of it, but we're all suffering chronic, ongoing stress from 100 daily humiliations. We don't realise it, but our body keeps the score. Our body notices, logs it away, and it affects our mental health at some time, perhaps in the future. Workers are subconsciously, at least, and sometimes consciously, braced for this sort of impact. And we're only relatively recently getting the tools to recognise this and the language to articulate it. And in the last few years, the freedoms to start expressing how we feel about things. In the past, it was shameful. It was stigmatised. We had a mental health challenge. And now, a hugely positive development. Yes, and be cynical about a lot of it. When employers say, oh yeah, just talk about your workplace stresses, and say, well, no, you're my fucking workplace stress. So, you know, we can be cynical about a lot of it, but I think it's a hugely, and I'm lucky, I'm not somebody who's had any particular mental health challenges, but I just think you know, this is a much better environment for people to be in now, that at least they can start to talk about it at the very least. Might not be able to do anything about it because a lot of the problems reside in the society that we're living in. And I'm conscious of time. We've had a few IT challenges, I'll try and finish off in 5 minutes. How has capitalism responded to this? As I said, it's not really responded positively. It's not really tried to engage with the fundamental challenge that's coming out of these books. I would say it's a fantastic book. You get to the last chapter, as usual, and you rip the last chapter out when it sort of talks about, oh, we could do a bit of this and maybe make this nicer. But nonetheless, it's a very, very powerful book, I would say. But what Catherine has done, of course, it's doubled down on all this. It's seen this as an opportunity to make money. Can you monetize out of people's mental health suffering? So what it does is it creates syndromes and disorders and diseases of dubious scientific merit, all the easier to prescribe. You've got a problem, we've got a solution for you. The number of diseases and disorders identified by psychiatrists has increased hugely in the last 30 years. They are heavily, heavily lobbied by the pharmaceutical industry in this respect. There's a pressure to medicalise patterns of behaviour and mood that are not necessarily that extreme or problematic, to pathologise conditions that are essentially on the spectrum. They're fairly normal. And in some cases, these responses are normal responses to insane conditions. But looking at how capitalism has responded to it, Goldman Sachs, not often quoted in a Socialist Party meeting, but they did some research and they asked the question, is curing patients really a sustainable business model? And that is the prime concern for all of us, obviously. The business model. It goes on saying, one-shot treatments offer a very different outlook with regard to recurring revenue versus chronic therapies. While this proposition carries tremendous value for patients and society, it could represent a challenge for medicine developers looking for sustained cash flow. So there's always that sort of backdrop in capitalism. That's where the pressure's coming from. How are we going to make a profit? So is this mental health perspective that I've been talking about, has the significance for the working class, for capitalism, for the subject of the summer school, the class division? So I'm arguing that we are possibly seeing mental health opening up a relatively new theatre in the class war. The battlefield's always been there, of course, but we internalised it. We kept it secret. We turned it on ourselves. We didn't talk about it. We locked our mad relatives away. We shunted them into asylums. We just kept quiet about it. Increasingly, however, I think this is a genie that's out of the bottle. There's no way it's going back again because it causes so much distress to start with, and then you can't actually express it. It just doubles it. I don't think there's any way this is going back into the bottle. The pandemic gave many, by no means all, of course, gave many workers a reminder of the stress that the modern capitalist workplace causes. Millions of workers were given the opportunity to work from home. Of course, many workers didn't have that option, manual workers in factories, care workers and the like. But a significant number of proportion of the working class did have this opportunity to work from home. And despite the existential stresses of COVID and the financial stresses of COVID, many found that they loved the enforced break. As lockdown then receded and the labour force was encouraged back to work, a significant proportion voted with their feet and either retired or decided they wanted to carry on working from home. And for some capitalists, this has been a real challenge. And if you're ever not sure what sort of what angle you should take on anything, it usually helps to read the Daily Mail, and that tells you exactly, take the opposite view from what they're doing. And if you're annoying the Daily Mail, you're probably doing something right from the point of view of the working class. If you're annoying Mike Ashley, who is the chairman of JD Sports and told all his workers that you can't have your dress down Friday at home anymore, you have to come into work because some of you were spotted posting on Facebook when you're meant to be working, outrageous. If you're Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, the Tesla founder. He's not really the founder, but never mind. He paid extra to be given the title founder. He sent a memo to his staff saying, you know, you're working at some remote pseudo-office. He was very sneery about the people who are working from home. He wanted them in the office, in the factory, that he could actually see them. This is terrifying for some capitalists. This is a challenge to their raison d'etre, their purpose. To you know, they don't actually add value to the process. All they do is check up on you. And, you know, that was the relief that a lot of workers found. I can go home, I can get the job done okay, and I don't have a manager, you know, pestering me. And I'm not having to be on show. I'm not having to dress up. I'm not having to commute unpaid. So for not all workers, of course, there's a whole debate about that. But for lots of workers, it's a wee glimpse of, actually, my job's okay and I can do it. When you take all the bullshit out of it, my job's all right and I can do it perfectly well. Here's another annoying member of the capitalist class. Sorry for those of you on... I always mean to call it discreet. It's not, what is it?
Discord.
We see a picture of a reclining Jacob Rees-Mogg on the parliamentary green benches and a picture of the calling card that he left on civil servants' desks back in March or April. Really sort of passive-aggressive. Sorry you were out when I visited. I don't think he actually visited. You'll have a flunky that did it. I look forward to seeing you in the office very soon. With every good wish. And it's interesting, that guy who's lounging on the parliamentary bench there, he's the Minister for Government Efficiency. hard to believe. Not only that, he's got two contradictions in the one job title. He's the Minister for Government Efficiency and for Brexit opportunities. Yeah. I mean, some entry he's got, I'll bet. So, it's... For a lot of capitalists, this is a problem. This is a challenge. They want to get them back in. They want the workers in the city centre spending their money in the shops as well, of course. So I think this is it is a little front in the class struggle. But behind a lot of it, I think, is mental health. Workers are enjoying their work at home for all sorts of reasons. And it's a wee glimpse of how work in under capitalism affects us and damages us. So just summarising then, the last slide is just pulling together the main points here. Really, there's some conclusions and there's some questions that you might want to pick up during the question period. I just want to say, I know I mentioned Hegel during the talk and the Frankfurt School. I don't want any questions on Hegel or the Frankfurt School, please, if that's all right, Chairman. But just in terms of the summary, the main points, I think mental health, huge and growing problem. Well, we know that anyway. Increased acceptance of the subject, I think that's a great healthy development. It's not, the capitalists haven't done that for us. That is individual workers just say we need to talk about these things. It's not political yet, I don't think, but it maybe it could be. I think it's a huge challenge for capitalism. The mental health challenges, it's their system that is fucking with our heads, excuse the language. And I think it's hard for the capitalist media to intervene and say, actually, no, you're not depressed. No, you don't have anxiety. They can't do that. They can't gaslight you, really. There's quite a strong, powerful culture of, no, this is how I feel, and you can't gainsay it. Number seven, they're not just poverty. So we're not just talking about the level of poverty, but this idea is trying to get over about the context, the level of inequality in the society. And all those graphs that you see in the spirit level, a correlation, the fascinating thing to do would be to draw that line back. You know, it goes from the unequal societies, the Singapores and Mexicos and the USA, and you draw it back and you come down to Finland and Denmark and all the nice capitalist countries. They're still unequal. You know, what if you draw all the way back, you know, and... where does that end up in terms of the mental health impacts on you? I suspect, you know, it's a properly equal society just will not be putting these demands on us. It doesn't just affect the poor, it also impacts negatively on the rich. But we're not too bothered about that, it has to be said. I think it's a very powerful analysis perspective. I'm sure there'll be much more to come from it. And ultimately, just to conclude then, it's a measure of how fundamentally capitalism harms us as human beings, and a measure of just how socialistic human beings are. And I know in the past we've tried to stay out of that debate about human nature, and we kind of say, well, humans are so flexible and plastic, we can adapt to any sort of society. But I think you know, the evidence that's coming out is strongly in favour of saying, actually, we are inherently, fundamentally socialistic if we get the chance. And it's only with all sorts of controls and measures in place that this damn system works. It only works because we cooperate with it and we let it work.